This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We've all seen images created by an electron microscope. Could be a close-up of the honeycomb texture of a fly's eye magnified millions of times, or perhaps the curved and spiraled bacteria that inhabit your gut. You know, the photos draw you in with their minute details, but they all have one thing missing. What's that? Color. Yeah, they're always, have you noticed, they're always black and white images. Makes you wonder what those photos might look like in color. Well, researchers wondered that too. Nick Stockton is here to fill us in on that story and other selected short subjects in science. He's a science reporter for Wired, based out of San Francisco. Joins us from KQED Studios. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira.
So, Nick, answer the question. Why are electron microscope images always in black and white?
This is really fascinating. So I didn't know this before I started reporting the story, but these things get so small that they are too small for light to resolve. So photons are just too big, either the photon itself or the wave, whatever you want to think of it as, because, you know, they're just basically the same thing. It's just too big to resolve that image at that small. You know, it kind of breaks down at about 0.2 micron or micrometers, which is about 1/1000th the breadth of a strand of hair. So beyond that, light really doesn't work. It doesn't diffract. So you have to use electrons, which are much smaller. But those don't pick up spectral information, which is what we get color from. They only pick up like shape and texture and contours and stuff like that.
You know, we have images from planets. When we take pictures of planets that are sort of false color images, can't we fill in the color on an electron microscope the same sort of way?
Not in the same sort of way, but there are workarounds. And what these researchers did is they kind of created like a hack in some sort of way where, so you do not understand what they did. You kind of got to understand what the normal electron microscope process looks like. And what they do at first is they treat whatever specimen they want to look like with a type of heavy metal, like a lead or something like that, because electrons like to bounce off that stuff. But then they found by using these like rare earth exotic metals like lanthanides, which are what they also use to make lithium ion batteries out of, they can make special formulations of lanthanides that will only stick to certain molecules. And so they say they want to look at, you know, a certain peptide going through a neuronal synapse or something, or a type of virus. They will concoct a lanthanide that will only stick to those. And so they first make that grayscale base layer using the heavy metals, clean that off, and then treat the sample once again with this special picky lanthanide that's only going to stick to this one kind of molecule. And then they treat it again, and then they come back, and they just kind of assign a color to that. It's not the actual color of the thing that they're looking at, but it helps them do detective work on the images they're looking at, so they can pick out, like, oh, okay, this is where all this virus is, or, oh, these are all the neuronal synapses we want to track.
So it helps them pick out the detail that they couldn't see before.
Exactly. Exactly.
Let's move on to the New Horizons flyby. Pluto made that last year and sent some amazing images, speaking about images. It's still buffering, though? It's still downloading, sending back to Earth some of those images?
It's actually just finished. Last week, on October 25th, they sent home their last little batch of data. And it took 15 months. They were downloading at about a rate of 1,200 bits per second, which is really slow.
It's the old modem days.
It's the old modem days, exactly. But they had to do it over 3 billion miles of deep space. So give them kind of a little slack on that.
Mm-hmm. So they're finished. Everything is done.
It's all in. Yeah, they got home 6.25 gigabytes, and it was pretty interesting process. Like they had to. I was speaking with Alice Bowman about it, and she's the operations manager for the New Horizons project. And she explained to me that they did this. There were 500 data drops they did over the course of 15 months, and each one was an 8-week process of setting up, trying to figure out or not trying to figure out what they knew this stuff was, but they had to index every little bit of data by the time code from when the New Horizons spacecraft became active. So they had to say, like, okay, we want the piece of data that was collected at, you know, 342,265,863 seconds after New Horizons left Earth, and the probe was tilted, you know, X degrees this way, Y degrees that way, and the RALF imager was on, or the LORI imager was on, and they get a piece of data back, and, you know, at the time, they didn't know what these things were going to have. They just knew it was going to be aimed at what Newtonian physics told them where Pluto would be. And then they got them back, and we get these wonderful things like ice volcanoes and, you know, a giant, beautiful heart on the front of New Horizons. And they did this, you know, this process of figuring out what these things were and running simulations on it and having engineers double check and make sure that this is going to get the data that they want and this is the priority data they need. And they got it all home safely, which is pretty remarkable.
Good. Yeah, that's good. Let's move on to California, right, where you are now. California is known for earthquakes. We, of course, you know that. But researchers are reexamining, I understand, a few historic ones. Tell us about that.
Right. So this pair of USGS geologists based in Pasadena came across a bunch of old drilling data from the early 1900s. Back when LA wasn't the sprawling metropolis you know it now, it was, you know, still kind of a city, but it was one of the heaviest oil producing regions in the world at the time, especially around Huntington Beach. If you see photographs in the era, there's just like a forest of derricks. Mm-hmm. And they found these records that people had forgotten about that had exact drilling data, like depth and location for these. And they started correlating that to some big, relatively big earthquakes that happened around that time, particularly one that happened in March of 1933, which killed 120 people. And they, by correlating the drill depth and stuff like that, they came to the hypothesis that these oil drilling operations might have caused that earthquake and not just normal fault line pressures.
So we're talking about fracking 100 years ago. Almost causing earthquakes.
Yeah, similar. So the reason they started doing this is because of the earthquakes that are happening in Oklahoma, and those aren't from fracking; they're from wastewater injection. But same kind of process. You're putting extra stress on the fault line that didn't exist before.
Mm-hmm. And so this has been going on longer than we thought. Right. These earthquakes caused by reinjecting that water back down there.
Right. Well, this is a little bit different. What they did differently was they were actually just sucking a bunch of oil out without putting anything back in there. And it was creating this what's called subsidence, and it creates this kind of pressure on the fault. And that caused the faults to slip. And since, you know, later in the decades since like that happened, they will put more water down into the well to create kind of a balance on the fault. Well, actually to get more oil out of it, but the benefit is it balances out the fault, so we don't get these kinds of earthquakes anymore in Southern California.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. That's really good. Thanks, Nick. Nick Stockton joining us for Wired magazine based out of San Francisco. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.